Hello and welcome to this podcast summary of the IASB board meeting taking place between the 13th and 16th of December 2011. My name is Mark Byatt. I'm joined today by Alan Teixeira, Senior Director of Technical Activities, and Steve Cooper, member of the IASB. Steve, perhaps if we could start with you. A lot of discussion on IFRS 9 and particularly impairment.
Thanks, Mark. This is the continuing discussions on impairment. We've, in the past, reached decisions about having a three-bucket model. Bucket one, having less than lifetime allowances, expected losses attached to it. Buckets two and three, a full allowance for lifetime expected losses. The key questions at this meeting were exactly what allowance should we put in respect of bucket one, and what would be the timing and basis of transfer of assets into the bucket two for where we have this lifetime loss. For bucket one, we made the decision that we would have an allowance equal to the expected losses over the next 12 months. So it's an expected loss model, but with a defined time period for the materialization of those losses. In respect of the transfer to bucket two, this would be based on having two things present: that there would have to be more than an insignificant deterioration in credit quality since initial recognition, and in addition, the likelihood of default such that it is least reasonably possible that the contractual cash flows may not be recoverable. What this does in effect is that it confirms our decision previously that the transfer to bucket two is based upon a deterioration notion. So there has to be deterioration in the asset to get into bucket two. This solves the problem of loans being originated into bucket two with a lifetime loss allowance booked on day one, which was a particular concern to the board. However, it's not just a deterioration notion, it's deterioration and deterioration at least to a particular level. And this, we believe, will make it significantly more operational than a pure deterioration model and produce a more suitable bucket two allowance. So those were really the key decisions that we had to move forward on this three-bucket approach. Obviously, we have to flesh out these things with appropriate language and examples and things to make it operational. So the staff will be working on examples, they'll be working on indicators. In fact, we discussed a series of indicators at the meeting in order to flesh out the basis of the transfer.
Yeah, because in terms of deterioration, one of the difficulties in terms of, you can't, perhaps if you looked at credit ratings and just took a drop in one step in the credit rating, and if you go from AAA just down one level, that's not quite the same potentially as going when you're in the BBB rating and you get a further deterioration. So the trigger point can be perhaps more sensitive as you go further down the scale. And that's the type of thing that people are worried about, and that's why it's very hard to just take an absolute deterioration, for example, or one level.
Yeah. There were a couple of other things that we clarified. The difference between buckets two and three, both buckets two and three have a lifetime loss allowance, so there's actually no difference in the amount of the allowance booked there. And it was a question of whether bucket three had worse credit quality than bucket two. That would be one differentiating feature. But the board's decided that we wouldn't look at that. The key factor differentiating bucket two and three, we decided, was the unit of evaluation. So bucket two would be a portfolio-based evaluation and bucket three an individual loan-based evaluation. We also discussed the application of the model to debt securities and to loans. We decided that the model would apply equally to those different types of debt instruments. The only key thing perhaps to highlight is that in respect of debt securities, we decided not to have a bright line presumption about recognising lifetime losses based upon a change in fair value. So the model applies equally to loans and to debt securities.
I think it's quite encouraging too. If readers have a look at the votes when ISB update comes out, they'll see that the boards are very much together on this, and that's almost unanimous approval and support for these aspects of the models, which is very encouraging given where we have been recently.
Okay, well that sounds quite positive given the importance of this project. If we stay with IFRS 9, Alan, perhaps you could talk a little bit about the discussions regarding classification and measurement.
Sure. Last month in November, the board, the ISB, announced a tentative decision to consider making limited modifications to IFRS 9. And essentially, what that means is potentially opening up the classification and measurement. You'll recall that we had already made a decision to push back the mandatory effective date to 1 January 2015. And by the way, that's that finalisation is published this afternoon. And of course, people are asking, well, if you're going to review, what do you mean by that? What's the scale of it? And again, just to reflect back, there are two things that we consider were important. One is that fundamentally we don't think that IFRS 9 is a flawed model by any sense. Quite the opposite. We think it's a sound, principle-based model. So we don't think this is a matter of throwing everything out. But we need to have a go back and have a look to make sure that the way we've described the criteria for classifying into amortized cost versus fair value is getting the right instruments into the right buckets, right categories. So essentially we're looking at reflecting on that model, and I don't want to, it's always horrible to use words, but you might say tweak or ask whether or not we've got exactly the right words, need to adjust some of the language, add application guidance, you know, and arguably build off that model. Second thing is we have to do it quickly, and that we don't want to drag this out and make this a long-term project. So essentially what we're doing is the board decided they'd look at three basic topics. One is the instrument characteristics test, which is the main thing about how you categorise between amortised cost and fair value. Secondly, they will have a look at the bifurcation of financial assets and consider any additional guidance provided for the instrument characteristics test. So you'll probably recall that the FASB in its decision has decided tentatively that they prefer to bifurcate financial assets. We require the any embedded derivatives to be included in the asset, and we either classify the whole thing at fair value or at amortised cost. And the third is whether to look at the expanded use of OCI or a third business model for some debt instruments. Again, we don't want to create expectations here, but the available for sale type of category, which is a lot of which was removed from IAS previous standard, is something we'd have a look at. But I don't think it's going to be necessarily a wholesale change, but we'd have a look at that as an issue.
I think important to emphasise that the key reason for looking at a third bucket and the use of fair value through OCI is linked into insurance. And in the insurance project, we're discussing whether and how we might use OCI for certain changes in insurance liabilities, particularly to address the volatility problem in insurance. And if we were to do that, then almost certainly we'd have to make some sort of change on the asset side. So the decisions about IFRS 9 and insurance are very much interconnected, and that was one of the key reasons for indicating that that we're open to think about some aspects of IFRS 9, was to accommodate the insurance project.
That's right. And of course, this is the opportunity we have as well. The FASB has yet to finalise its model, and this is a chance for us to, again, exchange notes essentially on this to see if we can reduce some of the differences we have.
Okay. Well, let's now go on to one of the other MOU projects, which is leases. Alan, there was discussion this week.
Sure. Not very big topics at all by any means, but a couple of important issues. One was on cancellable leases, and essentially this is cancellable leases and identifying whether they're short-term or not. One of the practical expedients or, I guess, exceptions we've built into the model is that if you've got a relatively short-term lease, 12 months or less, you've got much simpler requirements. It's not, you don't have to bring on board the liability and the asset. You can simply account for the payments and or receipt of the payments. And the question is, what happens if you've got a lease with perhaps a cancellation option in there? And essentially, the board's decided that you only have to, the lease of proposals will only apply, in other words, to bring in the asset and liability, only in the periods in which the enforceable rights and obligations arise. Now, take a simple example. Steve and I were talking before we came in to do the podcast. When I came to London nearly 7 years ago, we weren't expecting to stay for a long, long time, and I've been here in the same house ever since. Essentially, initial contract was something like 6 months, and then it's something like a month's notice in the house. I've been there for nearly 7 years, but I wouldn't classify that as being a long-term lease with an asset and a liability. Essentially, that would be classified as short-term. The other couple of issues we looked at to do with investment properties. Essentially, you know, there's a scope out for those, and that if you've got the lease of an investment property as a lessor, then you simply apply the investment property accounting to that. And what the ISB's decided is that for leases of an investment property, the lessor should recognise the rental income on a straight line basis or another systematic basis. It's more representative of the pattern. And all our board members agree to that. The FASB's got a slight complexity here because at the moment they're looking to develop a standard that deals with investment property entities or investment property companies. So they've decided that if you've got the lease of an investment property and the lessor is not an investment property entity, so essentially they wouldn't be using the investment property accounting, they too would also recognise the rental income on a straight line basis. So it's just a slight complication for them.
Okay. Steve, you mentioned insurance in the context of IFRS 9. There's a discussion during the board meeting on the insurance project itself.
Yeah, we discussed a number of aspects of insurance. The first was participating contracts. This is one of the areas where previously the two boards had disagreed. However, at this meeting, FASB reported to the IASB about a FASB-only meeting that they'd had recently where they had modified their prior decision and essentially now are converged with what the IASB previously decided, which is that you measure performance-linked participating contracts consistent with the measurement of the underlying assets, and that solves a number of problems in respect of measuring participation features. Should be emphasised, though, that that particular decision still means that embedded options and guarantees within these contracts would be measured on a market-consistent current value basis. And that was one of the fears I know of some users from this decision, that they wouldn't have that current valuation for those features. So the board's just reconfirmed that that indeed was the case. Second area is discounting of the liability for claims incurred. This is in the premium allocation approach, where you have a liability in the balance sheet in respect of future payments to satisfy claims. The key question is whether discounting should be applied or not. In many jurisdictions at the moment, these liabilities are not discounted. The boards had previously tentatively decided that they would be discounted, subject to a materiality threshold, of course. And in this meeting, the board unanimously approved that prior decision and reconfirmed that these liabilities should be discounted. Having said that, clearly discounting should not apply when the effect is not material, and so that pervasive constraint within IFRS accounting would remain. And secondly, the board's decided that in addition to that, we would provide a practical expedient so that insurers are not required to discount claims liabilities when the settlement is going to be within 1 year. So this is rather similar to the practical expedient we've given in revenue recognition, where you don't have to allow for time value of money, again, on a 1 year time horizon. Moving on to unit of account and then on to onerous contracts, we had a discussion about what unit of account, so this is the portfolio individual contract cohort, should be used in different areas of insurance contract accounting. We didn't make decisions in respect of that. We did, however, make a tentative decision in respect of the risk adjustment and confirmed the objective of the risk adjustment and decided that because of that very clear objective, it wasn't necessary to specify a unit of account for the risk adjustment specifically. But the issue of unit of account for other aspects of the project, we're going to revisit that in the future. And then lastly, on onerous contracts, we reconfirm the need for an onerous contract test based upon the present value of future cash flows, and that's required in the building block model for a limited circumstances, which is the pre-coverage period. We don't need it beyond that because the building block model is automatically takes into account changes in cash flows because it's a current value measure. Premium allocation approach, we need a impairment test within the coverage period. So So we reconfirmed that and agreed that about the methodology for doing that, that it should be on a present value basis and it should be consistent with the measurement elsewhere in the insurance project. We didn't quite finish that. We ran out of time, particularly in respect to the risk adjustment for the premium allocation approach, onerous contract test, and that's something that we'll return to at a later date.
Okay. Alan, perhaps you could just mop up any remaining subjects that were discussed.
Sure. We also had an education session on macro hedging. Again, it's an important issue for us. So we spent a bit of time early in the week discussing that. It was just an education session, so no decisions at all. It's also quite a busy week for us in terms of publications. By the time people hear this this podcast, we'll have published, and that's on Friday 16th, two amendments. One is some additions or amendments to IFRS 7 that deal with offsetting. So these are new disclosure requirements that we think will help improve the transparency about the rights that modifications to rights that offsetting give you, and they are effective from 1 January 2013. Related to that as well, we also have some amendments to IAS 32. We've added some application guidance to just clarify some issues about when right of offsetting actually should lead to offsetting within financial statements. That was out today, and I think that's effective from 1 January 2014. The other thing that we goes out is just confirmation of the extension of the effective date, mandatory effective date for IFRS 9 to 1 January 2015. And related to that is that we've actually built into that now and are providing disclosure concessions for when people first adopt IFRS 9. So they were previously limited to just a narrow time period. We've now extended that more widely. Coming up next week, we have an exposure draft coming out looking at the transitional provisions for IFRS 10. There has been some concern that IFRS 10 transition is quite onerous and that people have to go and have a look at potential subsidiaries they might have disposed of in the comparative period. And what we're doing is just clarifying that the board never intended that to happen. You're only supposed to assess what holdings you have at the date of transition. So, without due process, we can't just change that or clarify it. We have to go through an exposure period for that.
But just to be clear, it is a clarification rather than a change.
Absolutely. The there was a bit of debate about whether we actually even needed to have this clarification. Right. But the last thing we want to do is have people, in disputes with auditors, etc., about whether or not they need to do this extra step. So we're clarifying that no, you don't. Mm. And it's important because it means that people have got plenty of time to move into the new standard because they've got at least a year from now to just assess whether they do actually have control. So they're starting to build up their information systems and work out. So that's why it's important that we make the clarification. And then early in the new year, just for a reminder, we've got an exposure period closing for investment entities, I think on the 5th of January from memory. It's important that we get comments in from that. And before we have the next ISB meeting, which is towards the end of January, there's a trustee meeting taking place in January in Singapore. And accompanying that is our first public roundtable, actually, on the agenda consultation. Because we've also got roundtables being planned for London, Norwalk, and elsewhere in North America. And the Interpretations Committee also meets before the board meets again as well. So it'll be quite a busy period between now and the next meeting.
Okay. Alan, Steve, thank you very much for your time. That just leaves me to give the obligatory health warning that these are the personal views of the presenters. They may not necessarily represent the position of the IASB. The official summary of the board meeting is available in IASB update that will be published on the IASB website shortly. Season's greetings to everyone, and thank you for your time.